Welcome once again to our program, the fifth in a series on Decoding Angels and Demons, a popular book by Dan Brown, also made into a movie. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church here at Terre Haute, at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the street. Our guest again, who's done all the homework, study to prepare this wonderful series, is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. And we've chosen the book. We did the Da Vinci Code before, trying to point out so many misconceptions that Dan Brown had in the Da Vinci Code about the Catholic Church, and also several serious as well as smaller misconceptions about the Catholic Church in the book Angels and Demon. So we're trying our best to correct these erroneous statements by Dan Brown. And the problem being, of course, he always states at the beginning of his books, these are authentically researched and are absolutely true from a historical, artistic, archaeological, scientific, and religious truth. So, Ron, welcome once again to the program. Before we continue, we're in the section about angels and demons, about Dan Brown's misstatements about scientific things, especially about Galileo. But make a comment that Dan Brown is apparently still on the popular mind because of the, for instance, the parade article recently.
Yeah, he came out with a book within the last week or so, which would have been the week of September the 13th, maybe the week before that, I'm not sure, called The Lost Symbol. And I haven't read the book, but it has to do, there's an interview of him in Parade Magazine. And Parade Magazine is a little magazine. It's a Sunday supplemental kind of magazine put out in the newspapers all over the country. In this, I haven't, as I said, not having read the book, nor have read much about it, so I don't know if we're going to find a whole lot of Catholicism, anti-Catholicism in it or not, although I suspect we will. But it's supposedly takes place in Washington, D.C., and all kinds of conspiracies. And I think that, if I recall right, the Masonic Lodge plays a big part in this, and things like that. Other than that, I can't say a whole lot about it.
Okay, but his picture is on the front page of Parade Magazine, so obviously he's still a person that is in the public eye. And I think you heard many people say, well, I know this is true because I read it in the Da Vinci Code about the Catholic Church, or I read it in Angels and Demons about the Catholic Church. And that's why we're taking trouble and time to try to correct these misconceptions, which are believed by so many people who read these popular books.
Well, travel agencies, quite a few travel agencies conduct tours going to Rome or going to all these places in Switzerland that have to deal with the Da Vinci Code or the Angels and Demons, but also the Da Vinci Code. In fact, it's interesting, I came across a news release in regard to the Da Vinci Code, and supposedly some book review that somebody wrote of the Da Vinci Code made the comment that Pope Benedict XVI had written his book Jesus of Nazareth in response to Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, which of course obviously is not true.
Sure.
It's like someone said that Dan Brown and all the stuff he writes is like a little mosquito to the Catholic Church as far as an annoyance. It's more of an annoyance than it is anything that's,
church. It's certainly affecting quite a few people's misunderstanding about the Catholic Church.
And that's why, of course, we've had these series, because we're trying to point out that there are errors, and a lot of people buy into these errors, and either doctrinal errors or historical errors, which could undermine some people's faith or even cause them to lose their faith reading such kinds of things.
All right, let's continue with our discussion, which we stopped last program with, about Galileo and how his heliocentric theory that the Earth went around the sun rather than the sun going around the earth. And how was that received? Copernicus had started the idea, and he died in 1543 in communion with the church, contrary to what Dan Brown said, that he was murdered by the Catholic Church. So could we continue to talk about the heliocentric, or the sun being the center of the universe and the earth going around it? And how was this received by the church historically at the time?
Well, as we had said, Copernicus, who had come out with his theory in the 16th century, wasn't murdered like Dan Brown claimed because of his view, his heliocentric view. In fact, he died very peacefully in his bed, I think after having received the last sacraments and what have you. He was a Catholic priest, or at least he was a cleric. He could have been some kind of a monk or brother or something like that. As I said, I couldn't find out from in the research I got. Some places you'll read, you get the idea he was a full-blown Catholic priest. But he never did really perform priestly duties. He always was more involved with administrative kinds of matters rather than priestly duties at some diocese there in Poland.
And obviously he proposed this as a hypothesis.
Yes.
A theory.
A hypothesis basically is an educated guess as to what you think the truth is about something. But Copernicus had largely worked his theory out mathematically.
Okay.
And of course, a lot of people think there's an underlying mathematics, some almost mystically. This goes way back to the ancient Greeks, even Plato, for example. But nonetheless...
because this was even... And Copernicus didn't have a telescope.
No. He just used some rather crude little devices to do his observations. And then, of course, using mathematics, was able to come up with his conclusion that the sun... A better explanation for the universe was that the sun was the center rather than the Earth. Well, historians tell us that Copernicus had delayed the publication of his book for years because, as one scholar has written, quote, he feared not the censure of the church, but the mockery of academics. It was the hidebound Aristotelians in the schools who offered the fiercest resistance to the new science. Still quoting here, Aristotle was the master of those who knew or know. Perusal of his text was regarded as almost superior to the study of nature itself. See, Aristotle had written a lot of books on nature back in the 4th century B.C. Going back to the quote again, the Aristotelian universe comprised two worlds, the superlunary and the sublunary. The former consisted of the moon and everything beyond. It was perfect and imperishable. The latter was the terrestrial globe and its atmosphere, subject to generation and decay, the slag heap of the cosmos. End of quote. He goes on to write, quote, Ptolemy was, of course, a Greek scientist way back in almost a couple thousand years ago, if I recall right. Quote, Ptolemy's methodizing of Aristotle to explain the motion of the stars was part of this academic baggage, and it made perfect empirical sense. By using it, ships were able to navigate the seas, and astronomers were able to predict eclipses. So why give up this time-honored system for a new, unproved cosmology, which not only contradicted common sense, but also the apparent meaning of Scripture? End of quote. He closes by saying, quote, such was the scientific mind of Europe when Galileo burst on the scene in 1610 with his startling telescopic discoveries, end of quote.
Okay, hadn't Galileo already made some important discoveries even before he turned to astronomy?
Yes, he did. Up to that time, his main interest had been physics, not astronomy. He had already formulated the laws of falling bodies and made other discoveries. We've all heard the story, supposedly, how he went up to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped bodies, different balls, size balls and things like that from the top there. I understand that he really didn't do that, but that's the legend. Or anyway,
I've never heard that story.
Moreover, as well as being a scientist, he was a gifted inventor, or he's been called a tinkerer, And when he heard that someone in Holland had invented the telescope, he immediately set out to build one, or to build an improved version himself. And as one scholar said, quote, characteristically taking full credit for the invention, end of quote. He was a person quite arrogant, and possessing an unbounded curiosity, he wasn't satisfied with using his new toy as a spyglass with which to observe earthly matters. In other words, most people had built telescopes just to see things off at a distance, rather than, you know, turn them on the heavenly bodies to use them for astronomy. And turning his telescope to the heavenly bodies, he made one scholar has said, quote, shook the foundations of the Aristotelian cosmos, end of quote. First, he discovered that the moon was not a perfect sphere, but was pocked with mountains and valleys like the Earth. You can't see that, you know, unless you've got a telescope. You can even get a little, you know, one of these little telescopes that children have and set up in the backyard, and you can see the craters all over the moon and mountains and all other kinds of things. And the idea, of course, is with that God, when he made things, the universe and the moon and the stars and the sun and all these kind of things, that they were perfect spheres. That anything other than a perfect sphere would be, you know, would make God's creation somehow less than perfect. Although, of course, theologically, we could go into that quite a bit. God didn't necessarily intend that the universe be perfect. He didn't intend that the earth be perfect, for example, that when he created Adam and Eve in his image and likeness, he put them in the garden and on the earth to help him, to till it and to perfect it, to help improve it. But nonetheless, that's another theological matter. Second, he discovered that Jupiter had at least four satellites or moons. And this proved that not all heavenly bodies revolved exclusively around the earth, as the Ptolemaic or the geocentric theory would have held. And finally, he observed the phases of Venus, which suggested that it moves around the sun and not the earth.
How did people respond to these discoveries with the amazing telescope?
Well, to quote one source, quote, the response to these discoveries ranged from enthusiastic to downright hostile, end of quote. For example, the Jesuits were the most prominent astronomers of the day. And the leading Jesuit astronomer was a man by the name of Christopher Clavius, who was skeptical of Galileo's claims. However, after the Roman College acquired an improved telescope, Clavius and his fellow Jesuits saw that Galileo was right about Jupiter's moons. See, you couldn't see the moons without the telescope. You couldn't see them with the naked eye. Also, they later confirmed that Galileo was right about the phases of Venus. Nonetheless, they were not ready to jump, as one scholar has said, on the Copernican bandwagon just yet. Instead, to quote one source or another source, quote, they adopted as a halfway measure the system of Tycho Brahe, which had all the planets except the Earth orbiting the Sun. That is, the Jesuits did. This accounted quite satisfactory for Galileo's discoveries, end of quote. This source goes on to state, still Galileo was the man of the hour in 1611. He made a triumphant visit to Rome, where he was feted by cardinals and granted a private audience by Pope Paul V, who assured him of his support and goodwill, end of quote. If anybody knows their history, Pope Paul V was a great pope. He was really the pope of the Council of Trent during that period, and of implementing, if I recall right, a lot of the reforms of the Council of Trent after the Protestant Reformation. After his triumphal visit to Rome, Galileo returned to Florence, but instead of concentrating on his scientific research, which he should have done, he began a crusade to convert public opinion to the Copernican system. He wasn't going to be satisfied until all of Europe, starting with the church, bought into his heliocentric system. And as one scholar has said in this regard, quote, this crusade would never have ended in the offices of the Inquisition had Galileo possessed a modicum of discretion, not to mention charity. But he was not a tactful person. He loved to score off people and make them look ridiculous. And he would make no allowance for human nature. which does not easily shuck off an old cosmology to embrace a new one, which seems to contradict both sense and tradition. Galileo was intent on ramming Copernicus down the throat of Christendom, end of quote.
All right, wasn't this what alienated many in the church and not so much the discoveries in themselves?
Yes. Scholars have said that when he started his campaign to convert others to his view, he was on good terms with most of the church's hierarchy. But he alienated just about everybody with his, quote, caustic manner and aggressive tactics, end of quote. It has been said that his position gave the church authorities little or no room in which to maneuver, that they either had to accept his version of heliocentrism as a fact, even though it was not a proven hypothesis by any means, and they had to reinterpret scripture in accordance with his hypothesis. And their other choice, was to condemn it. Well, the church offered a third alternative, which he rejected, which Galileo rejected as a solution or as a compromise, which was that the Copernicanism was a hypothesis that needed further proof, which of course was true. In spite of his lack of proof, one scholar has written, quote, Galileo launched his campaign with a series of pamphlets and letters which were circulated all over Europe. Along the way, he picked fights with a number of churchmen on peripheral issues, which helped to stack the deck against him. And despite the warnings of his friends in Rome, he insisted on moving the debate into theological grounds, end of quote. In fact, some of the ones that warned him were popes. One of them was a good friend of his.
I think Robert Bellarmine, also the theological leader of the Counter-Reformation, was a good friend of Galileo's.
Yes.
And cautioned him to try to be a little more moderate.
That's true.
Okay. Well, in other words, Galileo, had he stayed out of theological matters, he probably wouldn't have gotten in trouble with the church authorities at all. Is that right?
Yes. One scholar said in this regard, quote, there is no question that if the debate over heliocentrism had remained purely scientific, it would have been shrugged off by the church authorities, end of quote. Galileo claimed in 1614 that certain passages of the Bible would have to be reinterpreted in light of the Copernican theory. That's where he starts getting in real trouble, making a statement like that. Recall that the Copernican theory maintained that the sun was the center of the universe and that the earth and other planets revolved around it, whereas the established Ptolemaic system or geocentric system had the earth as the center of everything. For example, Joshua's command that the sun stand still being the most famous of all the scripture quotes. That's found in Joshua 10, 12 through 14 verses. Another is Ecclesiastes 1, 4 through 6, which states, quote, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises, end of quote. And then there are several psalms, such as Psalm 104, 5th verse, that says, quote, thou didst set the earth on its foundation so that it would never be shaken, end of quote. Well, of course, these hardly exhaust the scripture passages that biblical scholars of the time could cite as confirming that the earth was the center of the universe. And one source has said that, quote, these are not obscure passages, and their literal sense could obviously have to be abandoned if the Copernican system were true, end of quote.
All right, so it became greatly heated controversy because he's spending these pamphlets all over Europe and letters and determined to say this is scientifically proved and so we have to reinterpret the scriptures, and that's where he got into trouble with the church about reinterpreting the scriptures, which actually happened. The church did say, okay, now we have to take a look at this and that we have to get in line with the fact that the sun is the center of the universe. Well, how did Galileo and his supporters react to these passages?
Galileo addressed this problem in a famous letter. He wrote to a man by the name of Benedetto Castelli, in which he pointed out that Scripture often uses figurative language and is not meant to teach science. He maintained that he accepted the inerrancy of Scripture, but he refers to Cardinal Baroni's saying that we've quoted, you quoted, I've quoted, not only in this series, but in several other series as well, saying that the Bible is intended to teach us how to get to heaven, not how the heavens go. We have quoted that statement, as I said, several times, and in fact, the first time I came across it, of course, was St. Augustine himself said something similar to that. Galileo also correctly pointed out that both St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas taught that the sacred writers had not meant to teach a system of astronomy. In this regard, St. Augustine wrote, quote, "One does not read in the Gospel that the Lord said, 'I will send you the Paraclete who will teach you about the course of the sun and the moon.' For he willed to make Christians, not mathematicians," end of quote. Now, this is, of course, Augustine writing way back in the 4th century.
Okay.
Castelli was a Benedictine monk who became the abbot at the Monastery of Monte Cassino there in Rome. You remember that was the monastery founded by St. Benedict himself way back in the 4th century.
One of the great monasteries, yes, of Benedictinism.
Yes, and it was a longtime friend and supporter of Galileo, who had been his teacher. Mm. In other words, he's the abbot at Monte Cassino, Benedictine abbot at Monte Cassino. Very important, very powerful man. And he assisted him in his study of sunspots and participated in the examination of Copernicus's theory. Actually, his views of scriptural interpretation are consistent with Galileo's interpretations, with Leo XIII's 1893 encyclical, Providentissimus Deus, on biblical interpretation, and subsequent church documents on the subject, such as Pius XII's 1943 on scripture scholarship, an encyclical called Divino Afflante Spiritu. Unfortunately, as one scholar has said about the subject, that in 1616, quote, there was precious little elasticity in Catholic biblical theology. The church has just been through the bruising battles of the Reformation, and one of the chief quarrels with the Protestants was over the private interpretation of Scripture. Catholic theologians were in no mood to entertain hermeneutical injunctions from a layman like Galileo. His friend, Archbishop Piero Dini, warned him that he could write freely so long as he kept out of the sacristy. Mm. But Galileo threw caution to the winds and was on this point, his apparent trespassing on the theologian's turf, that his enemies were finally able to nail him.
All right. Lots of details that you've looked up for us, Ron, and very helpful. We've spent considerable time discussing the different senses of Scripture in two previous series on the Bible that we did. It seems that a review of these would be a big help to better understand the problem of interpreting the meaning of passages in the Bible.
Yes, I think it would. In fact, I teach a class on the Bible at John Paul II Catholic High School, and we spend a considerable time in class looking at the senses of Scripture. And also the genres, because you just can't understand the Bible if you don't understand the idea of the senses of Scripture and the idea of genres or different forms, because the meaning, the way it's intended to be interpreted, will depend on that.
Genres meaning if it's poetry,
yes,
or if it's a parable,
or
a
prophetic type, or apocalyptic, or what kind, yes. In brief, Catholics and most Protestants tend to look at interpreting the Bible differently. Contemporary Roman Catholic, Anglican, or Episcopalian in the United States, and Lutheran scholars, they tend to read the Bible in an allegorical sense, and they tend to look at the spiritual sense or the allegorical sense in the interpretation of Scripture, which a lot of Protestants don't. By allegory, I mean a literary form that tells a story to present a truth or to enforce a moral point of view. Catholics, at least, since the time of St. Augustine, and probably even before that, of course, with Origen, have interpreted the Bible in two senses, the literal and the spiritual. The meaning of the literal sense is pretty obvious. The text means what it says. But that's easier said than done, of course.
Mm-hmm.
When you have to consider genres, the type of literature it is, and the intention of the author, and something about the author, and the time in which he's lived, you know, and things like that. However, the spiritual sense is broken down further into three additional senses. The analogical sense, which means similarity, the tropological sense, which means moral, and the anagogical sense, which is meant to matters dealing with salvation and the final destination of mankind. Now, I don't want to go into those because we spent quite a bit of time on the two series that you referred to a while ago, going into the meaning and giving lots of examples of those. Catholics apply the three spiritual senses to the entire Bible and not just to the book of Genesis. In fact, we just got through studying the book of Genesis, or the first 11 chapters, I might add, of Genesis, that deals with the creation and the fall and the beginnings of the redemption in my class on the Bible.
Mm.
The approach to interpreting the Bible has been affirmed in many church documents, including the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Ron, let's both say something about the literal interpretation of Scripture. I'd like to say a nice distinction is literal and literalistic. For instance, literalistic would be Jesus said, if you do not hate your father and mother and love me more than your parents, you cannot be my disciples. Now, he didn't obviously literalistically mean hate our mother and father. He was talking about a value system that we have to put him first, and then we obviously the commandment is to love our father and mother.
In other words, a spiritual meaning.
A spiritual meaning. So it's not literalistic. It's what Jesus meant to say, but it's not literalistic. How about an example about topology?
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about typology in one of the series anyway. And what it is, you have types in the Old Testament, which is a person, a place, a thing, a situation, an event, or something like that, that refers to or foreshadows or prefigures or hints at something greater in the New Testament. For example, take the manna that the Israelites, that God provided for them in the desert. This is bread from heaven. But it has a double meaning. It has a hidden meaning in it too. The manna, of course, symbolizes or hints at or foreshadows something much greater than the New Testament. And that, of course, is the bread of life that comes down from heaven, of course, Jesus himself. He and his famous sermon, the bread of life sermon, in chapter 6 of John, refers to him being the manna.
Ron, thanks. We're concluding. Our time is out. Decoding Angels and Demons. And this is your host saying, may God bless you all, always and in always.